territory technically unoccupied and open to acquisition, those arguments, which had been fundamental to many of the earlier claims by Western European colonial powers, were rejected by the International Court of Justice, therefore reopening in many ways, legitimating the reopening of the questions of acquisition of sovereignty and therefore of the political and territorial claims of indigenous populations. I would like to add on the last page a few items. The 1982 World Bank publication, Tribal Groups and Economic Development. This has been regarded by many indigenous spokespeople as a gussying up of modern economic imperialism, and so there may be questions about my adding it. I find it interesting that the World Bank found it necessary or appropriate to explicitly deal with the question of economic development in tribal areas. They were talking about essentially third world situations, particular African, South Pacific, and interior of South America situations. They noted that previous funding arrangements through the World Bank for projects in this area had simply not mentioned the existence of tribal populations in the area at all, and that this had often resulted in problems with the projects. And so at least in the self-interest of the World Bank and these development projects, a somewhat more realistic approach would be necessary. In that context, the World Bank study suggests that since nation states commonly recognize that individuals and groups within the state can acquire property rights by prescription, that is, by long use, that it would be a denial of equality not to recognize the same principle in terms of indigenous populations. And therefore, indigenous populations still in the use of their land should have the territorial rights respected by the law of the nation state. The World Bank study also suggests they don't say that. The World Bank study also suggests that in addition to recognition of land rights, there is a need for special protective measures if the indigenous populations are in fact going to have some hopes of survival within the nation states. Another thing I would add is the interesting coincidence of the publication of the report of the Special Committee on Indian Self-Government in Canada in November of 1983 and the report of the Australian Senate Committee on the idea of a compact between Aboriginals in Australia and the state of Australia. There are certain problems, of course, with I think particularly the second report, the Australian report. It has not accepted, it seems to me, one of the fundamental concepts that political power, by the analysis of indigenous populations, is with the traditional political units. And therefore, the whole way in which new political relationships are to be negotiated, it seems to me, is structured in a colonial way still in that report. Would note also the Kowarta, K-O-O-W-A-R-T-A, decision of the Australian High Court in 1982, in which you get an interesting interaction of the international law on human rights and the questions of domestic Aboriginal policy. The Queensland state policy of refusing to transfer leasehold lands to Aboriginal collectivities was declared to be invalid because it was in conflict with national legislation prohibiting racial discrimination. But the basis on which the national legislation could apply to a matter of state policy was the external affairs power in the Australian Constitution. The external affairs power was legitimate because of international covenants signed by Australia prohibiting racial discrimination. Therefore, elements of international law, in fact, affected the balance of power within Australia, and in that case, favorably to Aboriginal petitioners. There is one more element of the what I've described as the reemergence, which I would like to talk about, which is the Canadian constitutional activity, but I'm in your hands, Mr. Chairman, whether you want to declare a coffee break or whether you want to postpone this portion of my remarks.
Well, I think we'll declare a coffee break. You and I can discuss perhaps the order in which to proceed. I had hoped that we might, after Doug Sanders has completed his presentation, call first on Mark Gordon of the Inuit in Canada, who is vice president of the McAvee Corporation, to discuss the settlement reached in Canada in 1975. That was the first settlement after Alaska. And I thought after that we might ask Shorty O'Neill to discuss events in Australia and what has been happening there, and then Robert Peterson from Greenland, and then Alf Isaac Kiskatello from Norway, so that we would at least at the outset hear from all nations represented. We might just see at the break who has arrived and who has not. So we'll take a 5-minute break and then we'll carry on after that. Well, let's drift back to our chairs. I have an announcement to make that tonight at 6 o'clock there will be a reception at the Westward Hilton for all of those present, including members of the public who are here, for us all to meet informally and get to know each other. And so, of course, all of those who've traveled from afar are invited, all others on the round table, the media, and the public. And please feel free to come to the Westward Hilton at 6 o'clock, and I think it is the Commodore Room. But in any event, you will find it, no doubt. I think that it would be a good idea if we asked Doug Sanders to complete his presentation by discussing recent events in Canada, since most of those coming tomorrow from Canada will know all about this anyway, so there's no reason why that he shouldn't tell us about these things now.
There was an unusual constitutional opening in Canada because of some historic unfinished business. When the Canadian Constitution was enacted by the British Parliament in 1867, no provision was inserted for amendment of the document. Therefore, amendment could only occur by going back to England. Some thought that this was an omission or an error, but in fact, historically, it's probably true that it was not seen as an omission, that it simply signified the belief of Canadians at that point that the colonial status, the colonial link to England would continue, that it was not being severed by the Constitution of 1867. As time went on, this remaining fetter or umbilical cord or whatever became completely indefensible, but the politicians in Canada couldn't sort out their own act sufficiently that we could agree on a formula for amendment to be put into the Canadian Constitution. So it took us, I think the standard quote is 54 years before we could pull off this final severing of the link to England. It was certainly not that England wanted to hold on to us with a motherly embrace. They were rather embarrassed by this archaic connection and were waiting for us to get our act together. Because of the competition between federal and provincial politicians in any federal state, it proved not to be very easy, but the peculiar character of Mr. Trudeau meant that there was someone who was willing to take some political chances and bite the bullet on it. Largely, however, in his own mind, as a vehicle for other reforms. Patriation, as we came to call this event, was not the goal in itself, because we, in fact, did not have problems in getting the Constitution amended. We had problems in agreeing on amendments internally in Canada, but we had no problems with England. But Trudeau wanted to use this occasion to put a Charter of Rights into the Constitution and also to make constitutional reforms of rights of English and French. That's simply a brief description of what the game was about. The Aboriginal groupings in Canada formalized a claim to be part of this process of constitutional reform in 1978. The initial response of the Canadian governments to this formalization of a claim was one of uncertainty and modest accommodation. It was not the beginning of assertion of constitutional rights on the part of Indians. I use that date in terms of a formalization of a role in this particular sequence of constitutional reform. There had been long-standing positions by Indians, particularly on the prairies, that the treaties were properly constitutional documents and should be formally recognized as such by the Canadian Constitution. The Canadian government, as an initial response, invited representatives of the Aboriginal groupings to a constitutional conference in the fall of 1978 and to another one in February of 1979. It's something of a symbol of the marginality of all this that the 1979 one was actually a closed conference, so they were invited to something that they could not, in fact, attend, even with an invitation. Nevertheless, the politicians did add Canadian Indigenous people and the Constitution as an agenda item, but one of many. And so it was seen by Indians that it was necessary to apply heightened political pressure if this was going to go anywhere. And there was a major delegation that went to England in the summer of 1979 to lobby with British parliamentarians and British political leaders on the question of patriation and reform of the Constitution. And there was considerably more support for the Indian cause in England than the Canadian government had anticipated. In the ins and outs of the next few years, the heads of the three national political parties officially promised, first, that Aboriginal questions were substantial constitutional questions to be considered in the constitutional reform process, and secondly, that the Aboriginal leadership should be participants in the process of constitutional review. The significance of the word participants was striking in that no other groups within Canada were accorded any similar recognition. So women's organizations, business organizations, trade union organizations, minority organizations were all invited at various points to make submissions, to take stands and make them known. But to no other groups was participation offered. Now, one of the basic things that happened was that though participation was offered, it had the familiar history of being offered and then denied in practice, apparently because the non-Indigenous politicians had such troubles with their own agendas and disputes that they never got to a point of actually making any kind of participation in the review process possible. But at a certain point, when the federal government had decided to ignore the provinces and move unilaterally, and were getting a tremendous amount of political problems on it, they tried to strike a deal with the Aboriginal organizations and insert in the Constitution a clause which would recognize and affirm the Aboriginal and treaty rights of the Aboriginal peoples of Canada, defining the Aboriginal peoples of Canada to include the Indian, Inuit, and Métis peoples. That section went in only to be pulled less than a year later at the insistence of certain of the provincial premiers at a First Minister's conference composed of the Prime Minister and the provincial premiers. This led to a major protest in the country and the considerable public attention and political embarrassment and the reinsertion of the clause modified now by the addition of the word existing. The modifications, the process, the breach of faith that it involved resulted in none of the Aboriginal leadership in Canada supporting the patriation of the Constitution in the form that it was eventually agreed to by the federal government and the provincial premiers. Indeed, litigation was begun in England, which succeeded in delaying patriation by 2 or 3 months. The federal government had always been trying to organize a midwinter holiday for us in February, and we're hoping to patriate by February so we could have a Constitution Day, which would give us this missing midwinter holiday. And one of the byproducts of this whole process was that patriation was delayed until April. And so Indian questions, Aboriginal questions, were one of the final questions and one of the two final most significant questions in the politics of the patriation process. That would be acknowledged by all observers of the situation, political scientists and politicians and journalists. And the one of the byproducts of this was a clause which had, I think, first appeared in the spring of 1981, committing the governments to a future meeting of the Prime Minister and the provincial premiers, a future First Minister's Conference, as we call them, to be concerned with Aboriginal rights questions. And representatives of the Aboriginal groupings in Canada were to be invited to participate in this conference. This clearly reflected the view that participation had been promised and had been denied, and that some way had to be, some way was being sought to avoid the accusation of bad faith. Of course, it was something completely different to have participation after patriation than participation before patriation. The political dynamic of the situation had changed very substantially. The First Minister's Conference was held in March of 1983 with representatives of 4 national Aboriginal organizations participating and members of other organizations picketing the conference center in protest outside. The result of the 1983 conference was a political accord signed by the Prime Minister, all of the provincial premiers except the Premier of Quebec, Quebec did not sign because of their bitter rejection of the whole constitutional package. It was not because of the terms of the 1983 accord, signed by the Prime Minister and all of the provincial premiers except for Quebec, and by representatives of the four national Aboriginal organizations who had attended the conference. The accord made certain amendments to the Constitution. It provided that there could not in future be an amendment to certain portions of the Constitution, those that specifically dealt with Aboriginal peoples, without there first being a special First Minister's conference to review the amendment proposals. And again, representatives of the Aboriginal peoples would have to be in attendance. The Aboriginal organizations had asked for a veto on any changes to the Constitution affecting them. So this clause was a rejection of that position, with a more moderate proposal that if Aboriginal rights were going to be affected without the consent of the Aboriginal peoples, it would have to be done on national television. A second amendment provided that the constitutional process would not end with the first First Minister's Conference of March 1983. There would be two more conferences required by the Constitution and a third additional conference required by the political accord itself. The meeting that was held last week was as a result of the political accord, because of a certain delay element in the constitutional provisions. The amendments have not in fact come into force yet, but will be come into force at the end of the delay period in May of this year. So the conference last week was by political agreement. It was seen that one of the major developments in the First Minister's Conference of March 83 was some movement on the part of the federal government in terms of recognition of self-government on the part of Indigenous peoples in Canada. I'll read to you just a brief portion from the Prime Minister's statement of last week, his opening statement. There is nothing revolutionary or threatening about the prospect of Aboriginal self-government. Aboriginal communities have rightful aspirations to have more say in the management of their affairs, to exercise more responsibility for decisions affecting them. These functions are normal and essential to the sense of self-worth that distinguishes individuals in a free society. The Government of Canada remains committed to the establishment of Aboriginal self-government, and it is my impression that the provinces are very much of the same mind. And so we are not here to consider whether there should be institutions of self-government, but how these institutions should be brought into being, what should be their jurisdictions, their powers, how they should fit into the interlocking system of jurisdictions by which Canada is governed. Of course, that's the end of that quote. Of course, his statement about the attitudes of the provinces was at least over-optimistic. And his description of the federal government commitment was perhaps over-optimistic as well. He tabled proposed amendments which would involve a constitutional recognition of a right to self-governing institutions subject to some content being given, some powers or jurisdictions being elaborated by a process of negotiation. In which apparently some jurisdiction on the part of the provinces would be recognized. This would then be implemented in the Canadian system by legislation at the federal and provincial levels. This was rejected by the Aboriginal organizations because it did not include a true recognition in the Constitution of a right of self-government, because it was subject to a process and was therefore an unenforceable constitutional provision. There was also concern on the part of the Assembly of First Nations that the involvement of the provinces was inconsistent with certain of the political and constitutional positions that had been taken by the Assembly of First Nations. and there was a rejection of implementation by legislation alone. Therefore, the proposal of the Prime Minister, and I'll table with the inquiry for your purposes both the federal proposal and the opening speech of Prime Minister Trudeau. Therefore, there was a rejection of a political accord and a rejection of the federal proposals for constitutional amendment by the Aboriginal organizations. This puts matters apparently on hold for a while. One of the reasons it seems clear why there was reluctance, particularly on the part of some of the provinces, to move at this point was their anticipation of a change in federal Liberal leadership and a national election probably this year. Some of members of the Conservative Party were preferring, it seemed, that the matter go to what they hoped would be a Conservative government in Ottawa in the future. The sense, I think, on the part of the leadership of the Assembly of First Nations was not one of frustration, but a sense that they had remained consistent to the positions that they had taken over the last year, and that there was some indication of movement. Premier Hatfield of New Brunswick particularly described in the conference his recent conversion to the idea of self-government, attributing it to lobbying by Canadian Inuit, which had taken place in the 2 weeks before the conference. So while there was a very clear grouping of opposition by four provinces, the three western provinces plus Nova Scotia, there was a sense that nevertheless there had been some evolution of thinking, at least on the part of some people. There will, as I say, be two more conferences required by the constitutional amendments, which will be proclaimed in May. The Canadian government's response to the Special Committee on Indian Self-Government report, this is a formal response which was published on March 5th, takes pride in saying that Canada is unique in the world in having a constitutional process in place. They may have found it a little more difficult to boast a week later. I would note, however, that Canada is not the only country in which these questions have been raised at the constitutional level. The Carsten Smith Commission in Norway was instructed to draft a constitutional amendment to give some recognition to the Sami population within Norway. That, in fact, was its first assignment, not its only assignment. And the Senate Committee report in Australia of last fall suggests constitutional amendment to empower the Commonwealth or national government to negotiate a compact with Aboriginal peoples in the country, and therefore is suggesting that relationships should be handled on the constitutional level and not simply on a legislative or policy level.
Well, thank you, Professor Sanders. Just before we go on to Shorty O'Neill, I understood, Sam Silverstone, that you wanted to add something to what Doug Sanders had said.
Yes, I had a few comments, and I also wanted to give just a brief overview of the types of issues that Mark Gordon would be getting into in the next few days, without going into too much detail. First of all, in terms of the relevance of international law and Aboriginal rights at this time, I think in our paper, or rather the paper that Inuit Circumpolar Conference has tabled at these hearings, we say in there that it's relevant that such an inquiry is taking place at this time, and that it has endorsement on the international level, endorsement by an international organization, two international organizations, in fact, and the fact that it's headed by Mr. Justice Thomas Berger, the fact that he is a Canadian conducting this review, all of this suggests that, as your, I think it's your fifth stage suggests, that these rights have become of international concern, and that they will be dealt with on the international level. We say in our statement here that, in terms of Canada, that the federal government is currently negotiating four major comprehensive claims. Together, I believe they cover approximately one-third the area of Canada, these claims. And in terms of the ICC now, asking for this type of review, I think it's very timely that we should look at the Alaska experience several years after it's been signed, and we should try and learn something from it and from a comprehensive claim such as the James Bay Agreement before Canada proceeds and before the Native groups in Canada proceed to conclude these four comprehensive claims. I think this whole process is to share our experiences and personally and I on behalf of the organization that I represent, Makovic, we appreciate this type of process. So those are just in the way of preliminary comments. In terms of the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement, Mark Gordon, who's a vice president of Makovic and who was one of the chief negotiators of the James Bay Agreement and of the agreement in principle that was signed before the James Bay Agreement. He's also been involved in implementation of the agreement over the last 8 or 9 years, and he brings a lot of experience to these hearings. So I'm going to leave a lot for him to cover in terms of that. But what we were planning to do is to examine the agreement, examine the James Bay Agreement, because a lot of its provisions, a lot of its chapters are based upon provisions of the ANSCA. Some of the things we did in the James Bay Agreement were efforts to avoid certain things that we felt were not what we wanted and which do appear in ANSCA. For instance, we don't have shareholders, we have membership in our corporations. Monies and rights are not distributed to individuals, they're retained by landhold, what are called landholding corporations, which are basically village-type corporations. And the monetary compensation is retained by Makovic and invested for all Inuit in Northern Quebec. As you know, Northern Quebec has about 5,800 Inuit, and Makovic Corporation is the successor to the Northern Quebec Inuit Association, which was formed back in 1971 to negotiate claims in Northern Quebec. So after an analysis of the agreement itself, to give you some idea of what the agreement contains and some of the problematic provisions of the agreement, we'd like to get into the whole area of the negotiation process, and I think this is of relevance and of interest to other Native groups in Canada who are now engaged in negotiations with the federal government and other governments, and to share some of our experience there. Now, it hasn't always been a pleasant experience, but I think there are certain common themes which we came across in our negotiation process that that we feel that should be shared with other groups at this time. Even in looking at some of the difficulties that faced the Alaskan natives in prior to 71, there's a lot of similarities in as to how governments deal with Native peoples in these types of negotiation processes. Many times we're reticent to even refer in Quebec to this whole process which preceded the James Bay Agreement as a negotiation process. Negotiation suggests give and take. It suggests, in many cases, it suggests a certain equality, a degree of equality in bargaining position. Am I talking too far or too close? Too close. In our case, much of the time it wasn't true negotiation because there wasn't equality of equality in negotiating strength. On the one hand, you had two governments, the government of Canada and the government of Quebec. You had a number of publicly owned corporations, the James Bay Energy Corporation, the James Bay Development Corporation, and the Hydroelectric, which is called Hydroelectric Commission, which is known as Hydro-Quebec in Quebec. And we, along with the Grand Council of the Crees, we being the Northern Quebec Inuit Association, were required to face off against these five entities. So the negotiation process, and I'll go get into a little bit more detail just to outline the types of things we're going to discuss. The negotiation process is very irrelevant to the type of agreement you end up with. Too often what's happened over the last few years is that people have analyzed the James Bay Northern Quebec Agreement without looking at the fact that it was a negotiated settlement. Now, this is not meant in the way of an apology, or it's not meant to defend many of the things in our agreement. I, for one, think there's a lot of positive precedents in the agreement, and I think there's a lot of negative precedents, a lot of things I wouldn't want to see used as precedents. I think COPE, CYI, are entering into the process now, and we've looked at their agreements in principle carefully. I think they've benefited from our experience and from the Alaskan experience. I see a lot of things in their agreement and principles that we did not achieve. For instance, in the COPE agreement, there's a statement of principles at the beginning, which we did not achieve, which I believe was a mistake. These are legal documents, and whether we like it or not, at some point they end up in court, and it becomes very important that we give instructions, we give messages, we give signals to the judiciary as to how we think these things should be interpreted, as to what was the thinking, to put it simply, what was the thinking of the parties at the time when these things were signed. And if you give enough instructions in the context of your agreement by setting out broad principles and under each chapter more specific principles, I think this assists the courts, and ultimately it assists and works in the favor of all the parties. The fact that, the agreement itself has a lot of these difficulties, but a lot of these difficulties relate to the negotiation process. And as I was trying to say before, when you look at the agreement in the absence of an analysis of the negotiation process, it's easy to say, well, your hunting, fishing, and trapping rights are not priority rights. It's not clearly stated that they take priority over any forms of large-scale development of non-renewable resources in the territory. Well, this is true. They don't. That's clearly a defect with this agreement. Subsistence rights do not take priority over development rights. But one of the reasons they don't is because development corporations, such as Hydro-Quebec and James Bay Energy Corporation, were intimately involved in the negotiation process of the agreement. And the Department of Mines, for instance, and Natural Resources in Quebec, was intimately involved. And they made it very clear that Inuit land selections in northern Quebec the Inuit environmental and social impact assessment regime in northern Quebec would all be negotiated around existing mining claims and around existing proposed future proposed hydroelectric projects. These areas were to be excluded from examination by the impact assessment procedure and would be excluded from land selection. So when people say, well, look, your land selections look very weird on the map. They look like you haven't managed through land selection to secure protection of your subsistence use of the coast. I would say, yes, you're right. They haven't. There's vast gaps along the coast which have remained crown land and over which Inuit have no substantive rights. So I guess what I'm saying is that you can't separate the text from how we came about in reaching the text. I think the two processes are relevant. Of course, in the end result, you're left with this. And as history evolves and as history goes on, people tend to forget that there was a process behind this. Finally, the third area, aside from the agreement and what's in the agreement, the rights contained in the agreement, and the negotiation process which led up to the agreement, there's also the implementation of the agreement. And I think here we have both Cree and Inuit from Quebec have very important messages to tell the other groups. And that is, once you achieve your agreement, that's only 50% of the battle. Then you have to implement that agreement. And you have to make sure that governments and other parties to the agreement that have responsibilities and obligations under the agreement live up to them. So in other words, the process didn't stop on November 11th, 1975, when this agreement was signed, the James Bay Agreement. For us, the process really began. Many times I look with a lot of interest and I guess concern at what happened with the land selection provisions under ANSCA, where the Act provided for certain criteria for selection, and then regulations, I understand, were passed subsequent, which differed slightly in their interpretation. Well, more than slightly, there were substantive differences with respect to compactness of selections. Now, we ran into the same type of difficulty. There's many, many common themes. We negotiated this agreement, and then every one of the 30 chapters of this agreement had to be adopted into provincial legislation. Now, the negotiation of that legislation took place after all the parties had signed the agreement. So you had an agreement being signed in 1975, and then you had another 3 years of negotiations taking place to negotiate legislation which was supposed to reflect each of these chapters. Now, this was a crazy process. We had spent hours, days, weeks negotiating precise wording for some of these sections, not all. And then we had to renegotiate over another three-year period wording which was more appropriate for legislation. And in that three-year period, there were real dangers that things, rights, which the government parties had not achieved, that they would sort of get a second kick at the can. And they did attempt to do this. And many of the provisions that we had secured in here were in great jeopardy during that three-year period. And then finally, in 1978, most of this agreement had been legislated in the form of provincial legislation. And from 78 onwards, again, it's been a continual battle in terms of implementing this agreement, to the point where in 1981, both the Crees and the Inuit of Quebec had to go before a parliamentary commission in Ottawa, to bring our grievances and lay them before government to say, look, this agreement is not working. The governments are not living up to their obligations, and we're having to use our own compensation monies to do basic things like provide simple health and social services to the communities. Now, I've brought a lot of this documentation with us, and I don't know if it's going to be read into the record or maybe perhaps just the titles will be read into the record and the documents will be made available. But there's a whole history to the implementation process. And we're still fighting it every day, every time we come across some provision. Right now we're dealing with priority for Inuit employment and service contracts in northern Quebec. In Chapter 29 of this agreement, there was a provision in our favor which provided that Inuit would have priority in terms of employment and service contracts related to any type of development taking place or any type of government activity in the territory. Now, this hasn't been happening. One of the reasons it hasn't been happening is because unions are very strong in Quebec, and not that our interests are always against those of the unions, but obviously the government has not spent enough time in working out a lot of these details. Inuit who want to work require cards, according to certain unions. These types of things would have to be examined, and we are examining them now. We're in the process of examining the whole construction industry in northern Quebec to see how our rights in here can be assured. Doug Saunders referred to and I don't know if I have it exactly right, but in terms of equality or laws being applied in an equal manner, I think I've seen the quote somewhere from Mr. Justice Morrow, where he said at one time, "It seems to me that to obtain equal treatment, to give equal justice, then it requires some form of special treatment." And this is the situation we're involved in now, where we're looking into into affirmative action programs and the degree to which the provisions in this agreement call for affirmative action programs. Now, to show you how complicated that can get, there are many organizations within our region which are against affirmative action programs because it may prejudice their rights. In implementing this agreement than government anticipated, and this was said in their statement, in their concluding statements and recommendations of that parliamentary commission which took place in Ottawa a few years ago. Now, since then, certain positive things have happened. The government recognized, at least the federal government recognized in reviewing the James Bay Agreement and its implementation, that they had been remiss, that they weren't living up to all its obligations, and they did provide certain additional funding with respect to schools and housing, at least. Quebec, the government of Quebec, has not conducted such a review, though we requested that they do so, and a review is called for to see the extent to which Quebec is living up to its obligations under the agreement. The other element, I think I'm going to leave to Mark the whole history which surrounded the James Bay Agreement, because it's significant. The 1898 and the 1912 Boundaries Extension Act, which included certain obligations for Quebec to settle native claims, the whole history which followed that, the suddenness with which the Bourassa government announced the project in 1971, the types of technical environmental studies which took place, which didn't justify the project, and yet the project just proceeded irrespective of those studies. The whole history is relevant, and it suggests that when a government wants to proceed with a project, or a corporation wants to proceed with a project, how easily they can rationalize it, and how easily they can proceed irrespective of Aboriginal title or irrespective of studies to the contrary with respect to environment. And I guess the interesting thing and the horrendous thing about it is that you would think from this type of process that governments and corporations will learn, but in fact, on a day-to-day, a week-to-week basis in northern Quebec, we're faced with the same thing. Hydro-Quebec still wants to proceed with additional projects to the James Bay project. There's the Great Whale River hydroelectric project, which is perhaps almost as big as the James Bay project. Studies are going ahead. We never really get to see the studies, or at least the studies which have negative results. We're never fully consulted in northern Quebec on these studies, except in an ex post facto manner. And all of this suggests that that little, I think, in certain areas has been learned. The spirit and the letter of the James Bay Agreement attempt to involve Cree and Inuit in almost any major decision which affects the territory. The whole theme of the agreement is consultation and participation. This is exactly what did not happen when the James Bay project was planned and executed, and this is what we hoped would not happen again. And yet, irrespective of those rights and relating to consultation and participation, governments still tend to proceed without consultation, without our participation. So I guess what I'm saying there is that irrespective of the agreement and its implementation problems, there has to be a constant vigilance as to whether the spirit and, rather the letter and the spirit are being respected. The media play an important role and have played an important role in our region. The publicity attached to certain environmental issues has provided a lot of support to Inuit and Cree in terms of the James Bay case, the court case, which preceded the negotiations and in the negotiations itself. Many times the negotiations, when they would take place in the absence of any type of publicity, this ended up meaning a lack of accountability as well. Governments felt, well, we're negotiating with Native peoples in closed rooms. We could say whatever we want. And they did say whatever they wanted in many cases. So I think an important element is publicity, is the role of the media, is the role of the public. And of course, you have to educate the public. The public, once they understand, the public is not stupid. Once the public understands the issues, they can participate. And I think it's in interest perhaps of all parties that they do participate. Now, this wasn't the case in our agreement. In the early stages of negotiations, the government had insisted that there be a media blackout, that that the sessions be in camera, and not only that they be in camera, but that we not speak freely with the press, with the media, after each negotiation session. And in the earlier stages, our negotiators had agreed to that on the basis that the government said, we're going to give you certain confidential documents and certain confidential information which you can use in your negotiations, but we can't share with the public at this time. In the end, there was no confidential documentation, we ended up losing a lot of valuable time and a lot of valuable assistance we could have had from the media. In terms of what the governments got out of this settlement and what Inuit obtained from the settlement, I think the government managed to satisfy its goals. They got clear title to the region. They secured our surrender and extinguishment.
How large region are you talking about?
Okay, we're talking approximately 250,000 square miles.
Is that the Cree as well as the Inuit?
No, I'm talking about north of the 55th parallel. If you include Cree and Inuit, I believe, I don't have the exact figure, but I believe it's closer to 400,000 square miles. It's one-third the size of Quebec. It's a vast region. And so in addition to Quebec securing clearing its title as per the 1912 Boundaries Extension Act, it permitted development to proceed. So those were their main goals. And they made their goals fairly well known throughout the process. There was no question as to what their goals were. And they used every strategy and every bit of leverage they had to achieve those goals. And a lot of the leverage they had was far in excess of the leverage that the native groups had. They had resources. They had hundreds, perhaps thousands of technical persons working on these claims. They could draw upon any department in the government to come up with a position paper to send people, because human resources became very important when you're negotiating 24 hours a day for 3 months. To be able to change your people in the negotiating room every 7 or 8 hours, that becomes a very important element. And if you don't have the monies to do that, or to have enough negotiators to do that, as the native parties did not have, then you end up with 5 or 6 negotiators for the native parties negotiating for a 3-month period straight, and the governments having hundreds being interchanged during that same period. Now, I don't have to go into all the psychological dynamics of going without sleep for many hours or many days, but all of this comes to bear on the process. And I say it, as a warning to other groups that are in the process or about to go into the process, that it is an exhausting process. In many cases, people may agree to something just so that they can get some sleep. Now, that is the nature of negotiations, not just native claims, but in any process, that one party attempts to exhaust the other and sometimes succeeds. In terms of our objectives, just briefly, Inuit at least, we're looking for a right to a greater amount of self-determination. To a certain extent, that was achieved through the establishment of a regional government. We were looking to establish our right to adequate services. This is key. This is particularly essential services, community infrastructures, water systems, airstrips for the communities. I'm talking about 14 communities. The right to participate in economic development, which takes place in the region, and to expand the economic opportunities available to people in the communities, the right to harvest wildlife and to participate in wildlife management, and basically the right to remain a distinct people and to achieve certain cultural rights and protections. The agreement is very weak in terms of cultural protections. And Bill 101, which is the charter of the French language in Quebec, quickly underlined to us in only 2 years after the agreement had been signed, it quickly underlined the fact that the cultural protections contained in the agreement are weak, if not non-existent. So though the agreement is looked at as a living document, not as a static thing that fixes Inuit and Cree rights for all time, though I'm only speaking for Inuit, it's something which evolves, it's something which can be added to, it's something which can be amended by all the parties. And it's something which has to be kept timely and up to date. If other legislation comes into existence, the agreement should benefit from it. Certain provisions of the agreement, in my view, are already outdated when you look at some of the newer settlements or when you look at some of the newer programs, policies, or legislation that comes out of the provinces or out of the federal government. But those were basically the elements that basically our goals and basically the government goals. In terms of the agreement itself, there's land provisions in there, there's environmental protections, there's subsistence protection provisions, there's certain governmental provisions, there's social and economic provisions, there's monetary provisions, and there's remedial and technical provisions which relate to the James Bay project itself. I guess if I had to sum it up very briefly, there's land provisions, government provisions, and monetary provisions. Often, when people examine the agreement, they focus more on the land and on the money than they do on the governmental powers. And the governmental powers, as as the North Slope Borough knows, can be many times much more interesting and much more powerful in terms of their implementation than the actual monetary and land provisions, because governmental powers evolve as the whole issue of self-government now we're talking about throughout North America and beyond. In terms of Quebec, we've set up a task force to examine self-government, and one of the elements we're looking at is to possibly strengthen the regional government to make sure that it gets a more independent type of funding from government, so that it's not so dependent on government for funding, to strengthen some of its powers in terms of land use planning, in terms of culture, et cetera, et cetera. And so the governmental powers are becoming very important, because long after money is gone and long after many of the lands have been developed or encroached upon, the governmental powers may still be there and evolving. In any case, the other final element, and that this is just under the negotiation process, is, and I'm going to leave this to Mark, because Mark was involved in this process quite closely. I'm not sure if he was one of the negotiators who came to Alaska in 1974, but there were a few negotiators from Northern Quebec that did come to Alaska to discuss on a type of fact-finding mission to discuss ANSCA. And they looked at the land selection issues, the corporate structure, the way the compensation monies were being received and distributed, the whole question of eligibility, hunting, fishing, trapping rights, and we did learn a lot from ANSCA. But in terms of the and I'll leave that to Mark, but in terms of the negotiation process, one of the things that I hope we can discuss with some of the other groups that I know have had similar experiences are certain critical elements in the negotiation process, things that these groups that are negotiating now in Canada, these comprehensive claims, should be aware of and perhaps can learn something from. One is the importance of the agreement in principle. Many people don't look at an agreement in principle as a contract. It's an agreement in principle. It's going to lead to a final agreement. It's the final agreement many view as important. And yet, many of the determining factors of what that final agreement is going to look like is found in your agreement in principle, and that requires as much energy as the final agreement. The whole issue of, well, at least in Canada, that faced us was the degree of federal support we got. The role that government plays, the degree to which the government lives up to its federal trust responsibility in assisting the groups. The whole issue of an adequate negotiating team. What constitutes an adequate negotiating team? Who do you get? How are they trained? What experience do you put together? How do you operate as a team? What is a team? Can all your negotiators function as a team? Sometimes people can't function. Certain people can't function as a team, and that may affect your negotiations. The whole question of equality of bargaining position between you and government. If government is funding you, how can you really be said to be equal? If the funding you receive from government to study your claims and to negotiate them have all kinds of strings attached, such as you cannot use the monies to go to court should negotiations break down. Well, those are limiting factors on you, and many funding agreements with government do contain those clauses.
Yeah. Excuse me, Sam, could I interrupt? We have to give this hall up right about now.
Yes.
And if you will...
I'll conclude.
All right.
Okay. So these are, I guess I've spoken too much, but this is an overview of the type of thing we'd like to get into in the next few days.
All right, thank you, Sam. Tomorrow morning, I thought we would ask Shorty O'Neill to lead off when we're fresh and we can hear about the Australian experience from a representative of the Federation of Land Councils of Australia. And then we could ask Alf Isaac Keskitalo to speak for the Sami and then Robert Peterson from Greenland, and then Mark Gordon from Canada. And I think we'll do that tomorrow morning. Just before we adjourn tonight, I want to give the floor to Maureen Kelly of the Pilbara Land Council of Western Australia. Maureen.
Thank you very much. The Aboriginal Pilbara Land Council have asked me to bring over these artifacts to present them to the Alaskan Native Review to keep here in commemoration of my visit here.
This I hope I never have to use on you. It's a flogging stick. And I don't know how to play that. It's a didgeridoo. That's a spear throw. And this is a dish we use for gathering food. We have a larger one that carries children in, they call a kuluma. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Maureen Kelly. On behalf of the Alaska Native Review Commission, I can't tell you how much I appreciate this gesture. And I think what we will do, I and others will keep these in safekeeping overnight so that they're not given away as prizes at bingo tonight here in the hall. And we'll bring them back tomorrow so that all of you will have a chance to examine them and perhaps talk to Maureen at greater length about them. I think that we will adjourn now. You're all invited to the Westward Hilton at 6 for refreshments, and we will reconvene here at 9 a.m. Well, Maureen.
Could come in handy, but perhaps the funding agencies or the staff. Right?
Well, they actually use those two, you know.
Still?
When they have a few, both get one, and one has a hit, then the other one has a hit. The first one down there.
Are you in Metro Office?